Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Google is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com. This is TWiG, This Week in Google, episode 21 for December 20th, 2009. Love your scroll bar. This Week in Google is brought to you by the new voice-activated Sync, featuring hands-free calling, music search, and turn-by-turn navigation, available exclusively on Ford, Lincoln, and Mercury vehicles. For more details, visit SyncMyRidePodcast.com. It's time for TWiG, This Week in Google, the show that covers everything having to do with the Googleverse and all that stuff up in the cloud. Joining us right now, it's great to have him from his garden lair. It's Kevin Marks of British Telecom, former Googler, former Appler. And I'm from now on going to introduce you as the father of podcasting. I think you deserve that credit, frankly.
One of the many fathers, I think. But yes.
The first to demonstrate a working podcast client.
Okay, that's true.
That right? So, that I mean...
The first one to demonstrate one that got it onto the iPod, yes.
Yeah, I think that's pretty darn good. So we owe you. By the way, the Electronic Frontier Foundation has decided to fight that bizarro podcast patent. And I'm very...
That's good. I sent them a bunch of stuff for that as well. And I know Dave and the others were too. Yeah, and I think
Thank goodness.
Person whom you're trying to reach is currently unavailable.
And that would be Jeff Jarvis, who will be joining us a little bit later on. Jeff switched from Wi-Fi to Ethernet, and it seemed to work fine. And, of course, I said, well, at some point, it's not going to work. So your Mac will suddenly decide, wait a minute. He's pulled the rug out from under me. And, in fact, that's exactly what happened. He was on here a minute ago. There we go. Now we've got him.
Right you were.
It always happens. Always. We were talking about the fact that Kevin is one of the fathers of podcasting, this medium that we're using right here, and that
and plus Adam Curry plus Dave Weiner, lest we forget. True.
But he predates both. Well, yeah. In a sense, Weiner gets credit because he put the enclosure in RSS.
Weiner had it working in Inside Radio, and it would download the stuff to the hard drive. The thing that I did was put it onto the iPod. So that was the addition I made, which I think made a difference.
I think so.
Oh, yeah.
Just a little. But, we were also talking...
I now need a good one for the Android. And what I'm doing now is downloading them and copying them over. And I think I need to write something for the Android.
You don't use Listen?
It doesn't seem to do what I want. Maybe I should play with it again.
What do you want? what is it you want?
Well,
before we do that, I better bring in Gina here.
So bring
in the others, and then we'll get to find out what you want. Jeff Jarvis is here from BuzzMachine.com. Great to have you, Jeff, the author of What Would Google Do? And Gina Trapani, who is the author of The Complete Guide to Google Wave.
Hello.
Waving from Brooklyn, where both she and Jeff are about to get snowed under by, I think it's 20 inches of snow you're expecting, almost 2 feet.
Wow. South of us, I think in Washington. And I think we're up here, Gina, we're more like, what, 12?
12, I think. I don't know. I feel like every time I look at the news, it gets higher or lower. Who knows? It's exciting, though.
Snow angels. Are you going to run out and do snow angels?
It's been a few years for me with snow, so I'm excited about it.
I have to admit, and I haven't been in snow in a long time. That's always the first thing I do is fall back and go wave my arms and wave my legs and make an angel. It's pretty pathetic, isn't it? And people in California have no idea what we're talking about.
In Brooklyn, you have to do that right away because as soon as the snow is on the ground for a couple of hours,
it's yellow soon. Yes,
ugly. Way it gets too yellow quick. Pretty quick.
So, what is it? We were talking about podcasting and Android and Listen, which is Google's application for podcasting. I've been using that, but you think it's not adequate, Kevin?
Maybe I need to give it another chance. But what I want is slightly more subtle, which is I want it to give me stuff to want and to keep track of that and feed that back. I think part of this is putting stuff offline while I was commuting and that kind of thing. But now I want a bit more from it. I want to have the ability to comment on it. I think there's more to be done there. Making it more interactive and more two-way, the way Twitter and the other...
You want it to be not just download stuff, but you want it to be kind of more real-time, so it's getting the programs in real-time.
Yeah, well, not quite real-time, no. I like being able to time shift, but I want to be able to react to them. I mean, there's a nice thing called Huffduffer. Have you seen that?
No. This is a whole new way of thinking of podcasts to me. To me, podcasting was, I thought, a way that you subscribe to a show so it appears on your iPod at some time after the show comes out and you listen to it.
Yeah.
But you want something much more interactive. So what is this? iDuffer? What is it called?
Well, Huffduffer. Huffduffer. H-U-F-F-D-U-F-F-E-R. What it does is it gives you a bookmarklet, and every time you find an audio file you like, you bookmark it, and then it creates you a podcast of those files, and then you subscribe to that, and you listen to them later. So that's quite nice. So that means that as you wander around and find things, you can share them there. So it's like it's kind of like a Delicious for audio.
Interesting. And it doesn't have to be a podcast.
It just has to be any MP3 or audio file will work.
Just has to be audio.
Yeah. So that, I think that's the beginnings of this stuff. I think when we started with the podcasting thing 6 years ago, there was always the thought of how do we make it easier to make these.
Yeah.
That is a bit easier now. We have tools that help that. But I think there's also, there's still more we could do there to make them more interactive and be able to respond to pieces of them and so on. So I think there's space there. And that's, some of that plays with my thinking about voice stuff while I'm at BT and telephones and voicemails, things like that. I think from stuff that is coming at you and stuff that is two-way to this partially asynchronous conversations. I think that's going to start getting interesting.
And I would add a third piece to that, which I'd like them to be more discoverable, easier to find.
Yeah.
If we can get all three of those working, we might actually have something here.
Leo, you've talked about saying podcasts are kind of over and videos, what's next?
I don't believe that. I believe that, far from it. In fact, audio is...
Over is strong, but you're
well,
changing your...
I don't by any means think that audio should be replaced by video. I think I'm a big fan of audio, and for most people, audio is a much easier thing to consume because there's a lot of time in the car and places where you can't watch video. But what I do think is that podcasting hit a glass ceiling about 2 years ago, and I think it was mostly an issue of discovery, although I think some real-time stuff would help as well. But I think people just can't find them and have stopped looking.
It's the same problem I'm having with apps now.
Yeah, there's so many apps.
It's a filter failure problem. I argued last week in a post, we'll talk about it later probably, about demand media and the kerfuffle around that. But when you have overabundant content, the value of curation is what increases. And solving what Clay Shirky calls filter failure is really the key challenge we have. And it's been the case since the internet came out. It's what Yahoo tried to do, is what Google does. But it's something you can never catch up with. Whenever we have something new, you have too much of it too quickly. Podcasts, Twitter, whatever. Apps.
Well, that's exactly what Huffduffer does, because you basically compile, as a curator, you compile a podcast of audio stuff that you find interesting. So I would basically follow your Huffduff, right, Kevin, and I would hear what you think is interesting.
You get a bunch of audio that I like the look of,
I love that. I love that idea.
If I'm on this show, I'll put the show on it as well.
The problem with that, of course, is that podcasts are way too linear. You can't skim them. You can't find stuff in them. You have to sit and listen to them.
Well, there was an interesting day we had with NPR a month ago or so in San Francisco, where they got together a bunch of people to talk about these ideas. And something they're doing very nicely is they're chopping their shows up into segments so that what you can get from them is the 5-minute story, not the 30-minute show. And I think that's interesting and important. I think that will help a lot as people start doing that. Rather than saying, okay, here's an hour-long package, it's like, here's the 5-minute story, the next 5-minute story, and the next 5-minute story. And if you can skip over the ones you don't want, then that creates a useful signal that you could then go back and share and say, here are the stories I listened to this morning from Morning Edition. And if Jeff does that and Gina does that in New York for me, then by the time I listen to it in California, I can get the interesting ones from them.
I don't know
where you see the build, not just the story, but you also see the ability to link directly, to deep link into audio and video.
Right.
And it becomes more possible now when you have the text coming on to the new automated subscript coming on to YouTube videos.
Yeah,
but I hate to be a killjoy, but how am I going to make any money at this? Because there go all the ads.
Right.
Well, I think it's the similar thing of blog discovery, right? With blog discovery, you search something, you find something in the blog, you read the blog, and then eventually you subscribe to the blog. I think it's the same idea, that you'll subscribe to the people, you'll subscribe to the story. That was always the thing.
I think that's right too, Kevin. I think it's the same with being able to search books. and you find an interesting thought in a book and you're more likely to buy the book. I think, Leo, the more your stuff is searchable, our stuff, I should say, the more people can go directly to a thought, the more you have discovery.
Yeah, you're right, of course.
It goes to the argument, you know, you don't want to sound like Rupert Murdoch.
Right.
Try the accent again.
don't link. You can't link in deep link into my podcast, mate.
Right.
And you can deep link to my ads, but not my podcast.
Well,
so Eric Schmidt said last week that, or 2 weeks ago in his Wall Street Journal op-ed, that he's giving publishers 100,000 opportunities a minute to establish a relationship with someone. I guess the hard part, you can see that easier in a text page because you can have relevant stuff around it, which is kind of the live story structure they're trying to go to. In audio, it's going to be harder because you don't have a parallel stream of content in a way. Someone's just hearing it. You can't put an ad next to it or a link next to it.
Well, that's but making
you
it. Parallel,
do, you could do a 5-second intro.
Say, Gina, go ahead.
Right, say, Gina.
You could do a 3-second or 5-second intro. You know, thanks to so and so, and then you know, before you do the 5-minute segment or the 10-minute segment. I mean, the nice thing about splitting up a show like this into 5 or 10 minute or 15 minute segments is that people could embed them and comment on something that we, you know, particular story that we talked about. And if they say embedded them on their blog, you know, if there was some way to sort of automatically include some sort of, you know, 5-second intro.
I'm absolutely not adverse to that. In fact, the only reason I don't do it is just the manpower issue. It's enough for us just to get these things out. What I'd love is a tool that would make this possible for end users to do that. In fact, we inquired if there were a way for a Flash server to you could indicate in the Flash player jump to this minute, and it does require a special server to do that, which we don't have access to. But that would be a great solution where we could just give you a mark and say, you know, here's where Gina starts her conversation about Wave. Here's where Kevin starts his conversation about Huffduff. And then and then people could go right there. And I think that
those permalinks allow people to gather around them.
Right.
Well, there
say,
are
wow,
chapter
a good argument about Wave.
It depends how you're posting it. There are chapter markers in MP4.
The reason I don't use that
skip to them. It's extra work.
It's AC. It's this enhanced thing. And it's not only extra work, it doesn't work in a lot of players. Well, right. I'm totally up. Believe me, I'm not against this at all. I don't. I was being a little facetious in the ad thing. I realize that our number one job is to get people to find and listen and consume our content. Right. We can worry about the rest of it later.
I mean, YouTube allows for this, right? I mean, you can chop out segments of a video on YouTube and watch just that segment. I know at least there's Tube. I think it's called TubeChop.com. Right. That lets you single out a particular segment within a video.
Well, that's timely because we are now on YouTube, thanks to you, Jeff Jarvis.
Yay!
Oh,
yay.
Awesome.
Yeah. So you can link into a timestamp at YouTube. Yeah, you can do that. I'm not sure you can set an out point, but you can certainly set an in point.
Yeah, it has to have a specific kind of Flash server, and then you can say jump to this position.
Mm-hmm. YouTube, I think you put #T equals and then a time, and then it jumps to that. It's something like that.
Well, I would encourage all of our viewers to start doing that.
I was just going to the YouTube page, Leo.
Yeah, if you go to youtube.com/twit, we have a Twig channel, we have a Twit channel, a Twiff, and MacBreak Weekly and Windows Weekly, and we'll soon all be there because Jeff Jarvis called his friends at Google. You're all going there now. Okay, that's fine.
Go
right.
No,
I'm not going there.
Jeff Jarvis,
don't go there, man.
Jeff Jarvis called his friends at Google, and we were awarded whatever this is, this special account that allows you to upload full-length stuff. And it's fantastic.
This is awesome.
Yeah, it's in high quality, so I hope you'll start embedding this on your website.
Okay, play with that. It's cool.
Yeah, we're very happy.
What's the Twig channel? I don't see anything under /Twig.
No, /Twit. It's youtube.com/Twit.
Oh, okay.
So it's the whole it's the whole network.
We're all there.
Beautiful. We're all in one. And then there's a Twig playlist, which I think is sufficiently granular.
Yeah,
I don't know.
That's great.
Yeah. That's fantastic. I'm totally going to embed this.
And it's high quality, and so we're glad about that. It's interesting. When you first upload it, it's low quality, and then I guess Google is, you know, chews on it. And then it becomes high quality. So, yeah, it's pretty cool. I'm very happy about it.
Yeah, I think the high quality encode takes longer. Yeah,
I would gather. We're not uploading in high def, but boy, the high quality does look good. So I'm just, you know, what I have to do is I have to do some work on this page so that we can have an obvious, you know, easier way to find the playlists and stuff. But this last week's show is up there on Twig, and it goes.
And thanks for their due to Steve Grove at YouTube, who's in charge of the news and politics channels.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you. Boy, that's great news. And thank you, Jeff, for pulling strings. It's nice to have friends in high places. So, but not live streaming yet. I think in someday we will have this ability to just say, hey, here's the relevant issue. People to blog it and so forth. This is kind of the problem in general with audio and video, is that it's just nonlinear. I mean, it is linear rather, and it's not easily searchable, and it's not easily linkable to a small part of it. Let's move on. You like Charlie Strauss's 21st century phone piece, I see, Kevin Marks. That's an interesting thing.
I thought that was very good. Did you have a chance to read that?
I just saw your link just now. It's from antipope.org. Gadget Patrol 21st Century Phone. This is in a product review. It's a big picture overview. So what he's talking about, the phone of the future, or is that the idea?
So his basic thesis is that the cell phone companies have been trying really hard not to be commodity pipes, whereas Apple and Google have an interest in them becoming that, especially Google. So that's the sort of overview of it. But he's got some very good analysis there. If you don't know Charlie, he's a brilliant science fiction writer. He's written a whole series of great ones, some comedy ones and future ones. He was at List for the Hugo this year. But he wrote a near future one called Halting State, which was about 5 years' time in Scotland. There's a bank crisis in an artificial bank and a bunch of stuff like that. So he said this is from the Halting State world. This is his prediction that effectively what Google is trying to do with the phone is turn the cell phone carriers into a mere pipe so that they're a way to access the internet. That's his analysis. And I think there's a fair bit of truth in that.
He says Apple is an experience company, a high-end mark. They don't want to destroy the telcos. They just want to use them as a conduit to sell their user experience. Google is an advertising corporation. Their whole business model is predicated on breaking down barriers to access, barriers which stop the public from accessing rich internet content plastered with Google's ads. We've said that before. That's all Google wants. They just want a better internet because it's a better delivery medium for their business. So he says he must be British. Google want. He's British. I knew it because they just always get their. Companies in Britain are collective nouns.
Yep.
Google want the mobile industry communications. mobile communications industry to switch to version two pure bandwidth competition. In fact, they'd be happiest. Problem is, he switches back and forth because now that Google is they again. In fact, they'd be happiest if the mobile networks would go away, get out of the users' faces, and hand out free data terminals with unlimited free bandwidth. But that's not going to happen. And it's the same thing that's happened with cable and television companies like Comcast. They, of course, there's all this pressure for them to become pure bandwidth companies. And their response to this is there's not enough money in selling bits. We have to sell premium content. Exactly the same position the telcos have.
Why do you think Google wants the white spaces to become super Wi-Fi?
Right.
So we finally get competition in that, and we get other opportunities to get bandwidth. And when or the idea that bandwidth becomes a right in this country, and that we see what happens there. What comes out of that? If we just imagined a world of truly ubiquitous broadband, I was talking with a consultant I'm going to blog about next week about the Postal Service. And you start to see a world where you really don't need one. And how much money do we all save in the economy from that? There's all kinds of implications to having.
But you guys, you're starting to sound like crazy hippies, because there are huge commercial forces in this company pushing just as hard back in the other direction. They don't want to go this way. Do you think this will happen inevitably anyway?
I think so at some point. The value to Google is so great. I can't find it. I thought I had put up a link to a post going through the economics about how Google could give away the Nexus One, its alleged phone, for free. And it's not hard to get there.
No, it's easy to get there.
With advertising, and it's not hard to get us bandwidth for free. It's hermaphroditic economics. You don't know who's doing what to whom these days.
So what's our consensus? Is Nexus real? Is Google, starting in January, going to sell a phone and undermine its partnerships with Verizon and T-Mobile?
Oh, I hope.
It appears that's what's going to happen. It sounds like January 5th is the it's not confirmed, but that seems to be the date coming from a few different sources. But it sounds
Google,
like
by the way, Google says, no, we're not going to do this. We're not going to compete with our channels.
Because I think they're going to set it up to say, oh, you can, you're going to have to use this on a channel, and you can use it on a channel. You can just do so without a contract.
So you think they're playing language games?
Well, they've been selling phones for over a year, right? They sold the G1 for
As a developer tool only.
And the Nexus One maybe may just be the next evolution of that, and people are jumping to conclusions, or they may have some other plans.
But well, that's the question.
They've been selling an unlocked phone for over a year, and there are other ones you can get.
Yeah, but how many? They've sold a few thousand. I mean, it's de minimis. I mean, T-Mobile doesn't care, Verizon doesn't care, because people aren't going to buy them from Google for $300 when they can get it.
Well, and if you need to put a SIM in it, you've got to buy that from the telco anyway. So
right, they make their money. Yeah,
you can use them as a Wi-Fi.
But now I can take my iPhone. I wouldn't buy the Droid before, because I'd have to commit to $2,400 end-to-end. Would I spend $400, $500 even for Nexus One and swap out my SIM card for my iPhone? You bet.
Huge opportunity for T-Mobile here. If they could get their high-speed data network everywhere and say, and they've already said this, they've already got the, you know, you don't have to buy a phone from us. You can go month to month. We'll give you a flat rate. This is a chance for them to go to fifth to first, at least with the geeks.
Absolutely.
But will they do it?
It's going to be an interesting January.
Can they do it? So, yeah, that's, you know, I have to say, looking at the Nexus One, have you played with one, Kevin? It looks like a really nice phone.
I haven't seen one yet, no.
It looks spectacular. Well, you work
for... Do you know anyone who's actually seen one?
I have talked to somebody who's played with one who was very impressed. He said it's... in fact, the general response from people who've played with them is surprisingly snappy. I think it's an A9 processor, Cortex A9 in there, which is the fastest...
There was also the report of the, quote, weirdly large camera, and my theory on this is that it will improve Google Goggles. Is that true that it's a big camera?
I saw that weirdly large. That was from TechCrunch. Nobody else has confirmed that, and my friend who played with one said it was completely just like a Droid camera. It's a, you know... Five megapixels.
The camera's fairly big.
Yeah, it's 5 megapixels.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it has flash. I think Google Goggles works fine with a Droid camera. I think it's what you need. What the key is not megapixels, it's autofocus. Apple showed that with its 3.2, is that autofocus is the key for things like reading, you know, these barcodes, these short codes, and for scanning in text and logos. I wasn't that impressed with Goggles after playing with it for a while.
Really?
Yeah, well,
Oh, really?
Yeah. It's not very effective.
I wanted to work on faces. That's the need I have.
So do I, badly.
That is coming.
Really? You think so, Jeff?
I was at an event that was supposed to be off the record, so I won't say who said it, but it was a certain high-level executive from a certain company said, yeah, basically it's almost there. It's just a ticklish thing to do.
But I got an email. I got an email, a very angry email, because I said the same thing. And I said, look, the government already has this technology. Let's put it back in the hands of people, because, you know, the Fed's got it, of course. And I got a very angry email from a person who raised a very good point, said, I have a family member who was assaulted because a stalker was able to find information about her on the internet, including her home. Do you really think it's such a good idea for strangers to have a device that they can say, oh, that girl's cute, and find out everything about her?
Right. Well, but the problem is, Leo, we always come back to this. Can you take any given device and say that it could be used to do harm, and then we live to the lowest common denominator? There is a risk at anything. There's a risk to kitchen knives at some point. But the power of visual search is incredible.
Yeah, it's huge.
Absolutely incredible. And the power of search around an annotated world. Gee, tell me about this place where I am. Tell me about this thing I'm holding. Tell me about this person I'm seeing. And also let me comment on any of those things and add information to the world about those things is so damn powerful that, yes, I understand the risk. There is risk. There's risk to privacy. There's risk to a lot of things. But
and the thing is, you know, we're already doing this, right? We're already doing this with Picasa and Facebook and iPhoto. We're already annotating all our photos of our friends. If you just searched that, that would be useful to me. If you just said, okay, this is that person you met last week in Paris, that would be really handy.
Love that. Oh, I'd love that feature.
You know, I don't need it to
maybe that's what they do.
World.
Maybe they don't do it. Maybe they don't do it in real time. You have to snap a photo. I mean, I think there's a firestorm, however, facing Google if they do this.
Yep. That's why they haven't done
Definitely. It's creepy.
And they know that.
It's
but I think that there's some way you're going to find the power of it. I mean, it... I wrote a post this week about trying to put together. Gina wrote a wonderful post about 2009 and all of Google, and I did my bad version of it, trying to just put together all these things we talked about last week and see where this heads. And you start to see the idea that search becomes visual and oral, right? Google gets better and better and better at sound search. The fact that Yelp and such, we'll talk about soon, I'm sure, becomes an effort to get social around something local. It becomes really powerful in ways that I don't think we can even imagine yet.
But Jaina, you're the sole woman here. I mean,
it creeps me out. It creeps me out. The idea that somebody can take a picture of me and get Google search results for my name because it's scary. You know, I bookmarked this last week and we never got around to talking about it. But Eric Schmidt was quoted. I think it was in that Google special that we all missed that aired on like CNBC or MSNBC. I guess they was asked about privacy. You know, what about people who feel like that, you know, that they want privacy and they don't want any company to have so much information about them? And he was quoted as saying something along the lines of, if you need that kind of privacy, then you probably shouldn't be doing the thing that you're doing.
Wait, by the way, I know we didn't talk about it on Twig.
I've seen it for a year.
I know we didn't talk. Yeah, well, exactly. We didn't talk about this on Twig, but we did talk about it on Twit the next day. And in fact, the name of that show is Schmidt Happens. And I think appropriately. And that's exactly the point I brought up, Kevin Marks. We had Jason Howell from CNET on. I said, didn't Eric Schmidt embargo CNET for a year because they published details that they had found on Google about Eric Schmidt?
Yeah.
That
was 3 years ago, you're right?
Yeah.
When that kind of attitude is going on, it scares me a little bit.
Terrifying.
And as someone who has had trouble with, you know, harassment online, I don't want, you know, I have a private mailbox that I use because I don't want anyone to be able to find my address. You know, I use a Google Voice number so to mask my actual phone number. Like, I'm, you know, like most people, kind of a freak about where I enter in, you know, kind of identifiable information. But more and more, you know, I do it and we all do it, right? Because the balance between risk and, you know, the convenience that you get for the risk is often, you know, outweighs it. But still, the idea that someone can take a photo of me from wherever without my knowledge, which you can do in public very easily, and do a Google search result and get my name back and whatever search results there are, it freaks me out. Then again, I mean, if someone has my name, which isn't, you know, a stretch, they can Google me just by typing it in. I guess it's not that much of a leap.
And they can
go to Facebook and see you standing in a crowd and see you annotated and have no connection to you, but see you annotated, have your name, and then go. I mean, I agree about the creepiness level, but I think that there's also what you end up with at some point is you have the law of the land works across any medium and any technology.
And we know how well that works.
Well, we have to worry about that more. I think there needs to be more stalking laws and things like that. To enable us to be, because the issue to me isn't privacy, it's control. I need to be able to control my information, control how it's used, control the connections I have with people, and give me control over that. And if I don't, that's the problem. You know, you go to other issues like what I've talked about here before, the theory of mutually assured humiliation, that we all have embarrassing things, which I think is what Schmidt's really saying. If you really have something embarrassing online, then that's probably the question.
Yeah, but if you're the guy who has the least embarrassing things online, then you win, right?
Also become the dullest person on earth.
Maybe. I don't know.
And nobody cares about you. I heard a story I listened this morning to this week's On the Media, the public radio show, and they had a segment from a guy who was giving a funeral for his name. He had written a story, I think, in the Harvard paper about picking up closeted college jocks.
Oh, boy.
And it was very popular, and it rises to the first of search.
Oh, boy.
But now he wants to be a fourth grade teacher.
Too late.
So he's legally changing his name. And so his mother is there crying about not being able to use his name, but hoping that sometime this won't matter as much so he can start to do it again. But he held a funeral party, a wake for his name.
Maybe he shouldn't have done that.
Yeah.
I mean,
now
look,
someone will publish his new name. Yeah,
in a couple of weeks, we'll be arguing whether Google should have cross references to previous names. I mean, come on.
Right. Well, they didn't use his real name on the piece.
Ah, okay.
Let's call him Peter, they said.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. Can you change your name and change your history? Not with face recognition.
Well, but the other issue about that is that in blogs and now in news, we argue that you don't erase your mistakes. You cross them out and show they were there. and that's the ethical thing to do. To try to change history, we don't consider ethical in the blog world, right?
Right. Somebody in the chat room said, you know, you could always just ask somebody their name. It's called socializing. No, we don't want to do that.
Good line, Lennon 2601, but who are you really?
I find it interesting. We've had two subjects here. In both cases, there's a lot of pressure from one group that wants this, which is, you know, either cell phone carriers or cable companies becoming pure bit purveyors, the other being Google giving us face recognition. There's this force in one direction, and there's this force in the other direction. It's very interesting how these tensions arise in this new world where you have very reasonably, these are really tough things to solve. And I'm not sure how I would go on this face recognition thing. I mean, I think they're both good arguments in both cases.
What's the next step here, right? If you have a photo that exists of someone, and the first step is the annotation of it, right? So if I don't know Gina at all, she's among some people, I think, who the hell is that? Somebody says it's Gina Trapani. I can search. That created a connection that wasn't there. Gina could have tried to be very private. That's the issue with Facebook photos and annotation, right? The next step is whether or not with that photo that already exists, I could do face recognition to find out who that is. I can do that today. There have been services for the last couple of years have been promising that. The next step that we're talking about here is only that I can snap you in person and find out who you are. At least there, you can see me doing it.
Right.
Right. The thing There's is something comforting, can, though, you that can... you'd have to ask someone else who I knew or who was in the photo with me who I was. Right. Or one of those people would have to
Not necessarily. I mean, the thing is your face is well known now. So you could Mechanical Turk it. We could put the photo up to the Amazon thing and say, who is this? And someone could go around and say, oh, that's Gina. I recognize that. You know, there's Jonathan Zittrain was talking about this at Supernova. He says there are police are doing this. They had a big photo of a bunch of student protesters. And they were putting the faces up on Mechanical Turk saying, do you know who this is? We'll pay you 10 cents if you identify the people in this photograph so that we can serve them with an arrest warrant. So, you know, this is the difficulty is that you can now use these other tools, these sort of distributed human-based tools to do this stuff that, you know, the machine-based stuff can have a go at too. I mean, the machine-based face recognition isn't that good. I mean, we've all played with, you know, Picasa and the iPhoto one and so on, and mostly it's sort of, it'll get some of them. It'll get the ones that you say, okay, this is Kevin, and it'll find the ones that look very similar to that, but half the time it'll say, my son is me, or my other son is me, or something as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true.
Whereas the human-based stuff on Facebook is much more, it's like, no, that's Kevin, even if it's me, you know, with a funny hat on or something, people will be tagging me with that.
I guess you're right. In some ways, this is a genie that's going to get out of the bottle one way or the other.
So we have to deal with our education. We have to deal with our laws and our cultural views of this and rethink publicness and privacy. I think it'd be a mistake to go to a complete lockdown on privacy because, as Lennon 2601 just said, we do want to socialize and we want these connections to happen. We can't be ruled by the one possibility that something goes wrong. We have to be cautious about that instead.
Go ahead,
Kevin.
Dana Boyd spoke at both Supernova and at Le Web about this, which is that we are now people are publishing more and more of their lives online, but we're still not using that to do good, using that to find people and help them. And I thought that was a really strong point.
I disagree with that.
She's saying there were powerless, you know, there were powerless people who put stuff up online and nobody pays attention to them until they do something bad, and then suddenly they're all over them.
No, I disagree with that, and I unfortunately will raise the specter of my penis again.
at least it's going up. Cancer, okay, go ahead.
I mean, incredible things happen. Wonderful things happen. I couldn't have gotten the support and the information that I got back if I had not chosen to put myself out there.
There's certainly benefits to living.
I think that's true, but her point was that there are people who aren't as sort of privileged as us, who don't feel safe doing this because they didn't have the ability to hide from the bad people effectively, and that was if you had a chance, watch Dana's talk from Supernova or the Web. I think both of them are up online. Really recommend that as a corrective. It certainly made me stop and think about what we're doing.
But I mean. that's no reason to say, well, stop putting stuff online.
Well, no. I mean, I think Jeff made the point originally is that the thing is that the authorities already have it. They have the ability. Right. I suppose that's potentially what Schmidt was saying, too. He says they're the government. They have nuclear weapons. They can get the data from us if they force us to.
Right.
You know, that's the, you know, at the bottom line, it comes down to that. And the challenge is, can we then give that data to ourselves and use that for good as well? If we can get the information ourselves and use it, we can probably make more sense of it than a random stranger can, because we have some idea of who our friends are and what's going on.
An interesting related issue. I'm going to. There's a thing called the Personal Genome Project, and Harvard geneticist George Church is doing this. They want to collect 100,000 genomes and match it to phenotype information: weight, height, baldness, medical history, that kind of thing. So it's a very valuable database, so that they can figure out perhaps what gene, you know, expression has to do with, you know, some medical history and that kind of thing. I volunteered to that. I'm going to do this. Esther Dyson has done it. A number of people have done it. And what they say in this is, we're not going to protect your privacy. We can't. So you should know that your forevermore, your genotype will be in public along with your complete medical history and your name. Right. We could make an attempt to protect this, but we know that we're not going to be able to do it. So we're just going to not even try. And so when you volunteer, you say, yeah, okay, fine. And maybe that'll make it hard for me to get insurance down the road or whatever. And one of the reasons I'm doing this, not only to publicize it, but because I don't have much to fear from that. And I think people need to, you know, it's such a valuable database.
And you create value with it. I argue in my book that when we get to the point where not sharing data becomes seen as antisocial, quite literally.
Right.
23andMe has a survey out about your reaction to H1N1. And at some point, by sharing more of this data publicly, we're going to find correlations that we couldn't have found before. But we can only do that if people are generous with their data.
So maybe that's what Schmidt was saying, is we need to get over this stigma.
Exactly.
We're stigmatizing information. And now some of us, like you, Jeff, are kind of pioneers in this area.
Or obnoxious about it, whatever.
Well,
but, yeah.
I think some of us have less to risk than others. You know, if I were Gina, I wouldn't do this. If I were a woman of any stripe, I wouldn't do this.
That's why the issue is control.
Right.
Right. You don't need everyone to do this. It's the Wikipedia rule. You don't need every human on earth to give their experience here. You need a statistical number who were generous enough.
Or exhibitionistic enough.
Out of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So let's talk about Yelp, because this is the big rumor now that that Google is planning or offering or thinking about, and it's not confirmed by Google, to spend $500 million to acquire Yelp, although in conjunction with Google Goggles, it makes a lot of sense. Jeff, do you have any knowledge about this? Is this going to happen?
No knowledge. I mean, Michael Arrington reading TechCrunch is where I start.
Mike, by the way, has a history of rumors like this that never pan out. So I'm always a little bit skeptical. I love Mike, but I'm always a little, you know, like, okay,
right.
Well, that's one data
point. It's interesting to me, because what I said was, watch out, or put it another way, newspapers and phone companies lost this opportunity. They could have owned this level of information that Yelp has. They should have.
They had it.
It's like communities. And so there's great power there. And I think that the next frontier for Google, besides the things we talked about last week, like more intent in search, is local mobile. And that Yelp gives them an incredible amount of data for local venues. It improves the place page, which improves maps, which improves navigation, which improves local advertising, and they bought AdMob. Yelp is also potentially a back door to social. I'll be curious to hear what Kevin and Gina say about this, because it's an opportunity to say that I saw one post that I think I put up on the friend feed that wondered whether this was a side way to get to Foursquare, and that you're talking about places and you're gathering around places and giving that data, and people are doing it, and that it's a social thing as well. So I think that's less important. I think this is a huge opportunity for Google in terms of local, and it has been newspapers and phone companies and yellow pages to lose.
Any thoughts?
The yellow pages have lost it.
It's amazing,
I put it straight in the recycling bin.
It's amazing to even know that there people are still chopping down trees to print these ridiculous books that nobody can use. Does anybody use the yellow pages? Or maybe we're just early in there. You know, some, there's still people using it. But
no, considering how well Donnelly is doing, Yellow Page publishers are doing. No, you're right, Leo. They're not.
Somebody's.
Gina, you're the youngest one here.
Oh yeah, she's.
Pardon me. This sounds mm-hmm. condescending. I mean, but Yellow Pages were part of how we found information. Were they ever for you?
Do you even know what they are, Gina?
I mean, they're part of like. They're part of like how I reach the really tall shelf in the kitchen. You know, I mean, kind of step up. I mean, I really never remember using the Yellow Pages in earnest. First started to use the phone when I was like 8 or 9, maybe. I mean, but not very much now.
Or even a phone book. Anybody use book?
Like a paper address book. Like, I had one of those for a while.
No. I mean, remember they put in white pages too.
Oh, the white pages. Yeah, me and my friends would go through the white pages and try and find like funny names, you know?
Yeah, that's what it was good for.
Yes. When prank calling was kind of, you know.
Do they still print the white pages, yes or no? Am I wrong? They still print white pages, right? I guess they have to. There's got to be a set of the population that's not online. Boy, that really shows you why, in fact, being online is a human right. Because it's not long before you're not going to get that stuff. That's why France did Minitel, right, in the 80s, was so that they didn't have to print, you know, yellow or white pages.
They saved money and brought more people.
They gave everybody a free terminal.
Well, that's where I think, Leo, that's where I think if you really go the full extent of the rumor mill and go beyond Nexus One to the latest rumor that's also comes back that Google's going to do a Chrome OS machine themselves – at some point, it's worth it to give everyone in the country a machine.
Why does Google need to do hardware? Because they can? Because they can give it away?
Because I think it changes the economics.
They could just say, we're just going to give it away.
It just
talk about disruptive. At some point, the U.S. federal government is going to just say, you're breaking too many businesses. You know, you're not a monopoly, but... I mean, is there a societal consequence to a company like Google that is so disruptive to everything we know? I mean, they are putting everything on its head. Or is this another case of...
It's not Google, it's the internet.
It's, well, that, or that's my question. Or is this just a case of inevitable and we just better...
Yeah, I mean, there are already, you know, companies that give away devices, right? Right. In the UK, you can get a netbook that you don't pay for. You're just paying the subscription fee for the connectivity. That's been out for a couple of years, yeah. You know, these exist. You know, I'm not sure anyone's doing that in the U.S., but that may just be because the carriers haven't really come up with it yet.
Most of the time you get these onerous two-year contracts, and that is enough. That is people have quickly realized that that's actually a huge cost of thousands of dollars, and I don't think it's – you know, you can get a netbook for $50, but you have a two-year deal. So
Google would say, do we really want government to come in and set these rules?
Right.
Sorry, Gina. Go ahead.
I was going to say, this is what I want to see. I want to see Google just stop this stupid contract madness and, you know,
they could
make this actually work for users.
With one stroke of the pen, they could disintermediate the phone companies. They could put the netbook manufacturers out of business. I mean, they could change the landscape.
You see, Leo, you're operating... You are playing back what we hear so often about, well, Google destroys something. Well, that's the economics of entitlement at a corporate level.
That's the sociopath.
It's a sociopath thing.
Yeah. Aaron Schwartz calls them sociopaths.
Craigslist stole from them.
Right.
Craig is the grandest philanthropist who left money in the pockets of the transactors and took it away from the middlemen.
Yep.
So who's to say that we should suddenly protect some old industry from Google or the internet and make life worse for consumers? That's absurd.
Aaron Schwartz says, naturally, the sociopaths are outraged that their control is being taken away. Newspapers, book publishers, television companies, ad agencies, their businesses are all failing. While Google's is on the rise, the sociopaths may be outraged, but this is exactly what's supposed to happen. Most people don't have a vested interest in whether ABC does well or even continues to exist. What they want are good television shows at a reasonable price, and if they can get those from Apple and Google instead of their local cable company, bully for Apple and Google.
Right, so Gina, you're rooting for this to happen, and if government stepped in to stop it from happening,
yes,
you'd be enraged, right?
Yeah, but...
Yeah,
but,
definitely.
So really,
definitely.
Though, but wait a minute.
Protecting businesses and screwing over consumers.
But wait a minute. Government represents businesses in the same way it represents individuals.
I'm going to bet that Kevin Marks studied that at Oxford or Cambridge or somewhere.
Tell us.
I did physics.
Physics. Physics. That's not going to help you. Your physics is no use here.
Well, companies are legal persons in the U.S. and to some extent in the U.K.
Absolutely. So the government protects property. Let's be very clear. Government really doesn't protect individuals. It protects property.
Except that we have a political will. The problem is we don't have the lobbyists. And so the way we're going to – that's why the political structure is broken, is because we don't have the people, common cause aside, don't have the lobbyists to fight for that against
– You're talking a revolution. This is a revolution. This is an economic revolution.
Yes.
The question is whether it'll be a velvet revolution.
Well, the problem is this. It's about things getting smaller, right? It's about a deflation that occurs when everything gets cheaper. And that's, you know, innovation and Moore's Law makes everything cheaper today. And that's not the way the economy was built. The company was built on centralized control and making things more expensive and what the market would bear. And you charge as little as you can bear now to be as big as you can be. And it changes the fundamentals of economics. And I did horribly in economics class.
George Gilder wins.
Oh, Umair Haque. You've been reading his recent stuff?
No, tell us about that.
So he's saying, basically, a lot of the businesses that exist are not creating value. They're just moving it around and extracting some of it. And he says his bet for the future is on businesses that are creating actual value by returning it to the people who are using it. So I suppose the Craigslist example is a good one. There, rather than extract the most money from brokering it, Craig made sure that most of the money went to the people using it. The other thing that sort of leads to this was John Hagel's stuff at Supernova, where he was looking at return on assets for companies since the 60s, and he basically said it's been going down. What's happened is they're not making money from being large anymore, and any money they do make is either extracted by the customers as better value or by the individuals within the company who extract it as wages. The corporations themselves aren't keeping it anymore. And in order to, effectively, the sort of old Coasean theory of the firm, where a firm exists because its transaction costs are lower, is no longer true in this age. And it's easier for us as individuals to lower transaction costs collectively than it is for a company to do it bureaucratically. That's a big change.
So if Google does something that, yes, destroys an industry, but that benefits all of us in huge ways, the industries are going to scream like stuck pigs, as they are, but do they really have a right to?
No, but I think if they only did it onesie-twosie, probably they could get away with it. They're about to do it kind of wholesale. And I have to, the only thing that's going to save them is that Congress and the federal government is completely clueless. And by the time they catch on, and of course these sociopaths don't believe it's going to happen. So by the time...
But the problem here, Leo, is I asked Eric Schmidt about this at the Aspen Ideas Festival this summer. And what he said was the change isn't going to happen as fast as you want, Jarvis, because the resources of government in terms of money and regulation are favoring the incumbents.
Well, that's kind of what I was saying.
Right. Yeah.
But I think that's disinformation that Eric Schmidt is handing you, Jeff Jarvis, because I think... I think Eric Schmidt knows exactly how quickly it's going to happen, and his sole goal at this point is to stay as stealth as he can for as long as he can so that it will be too late by the time the vested interests
wake up
to this. That's
what amazed me about Gina's post this week about 2009 and about our discussion of the show last week.
What a year this has been.
When you start to add it up, it's awe-inspiring. Each one is rather stealthy, is rather small. Okay, so they did this, they did that. You add it together, and it starts to show to me, maybe it's just my scales on my eyes, I start to see the strategy come into clearer focus.
No, I'm with you. And I think if you don't listen to this show, you may not, it may not become clear. But when you, just from doing this show, and we've done 21 episodes, and I guess, Gina, you knew all along, but it's become extremely clear that we are in, this has been a transformative year, and is accelerating rapidly. Was that your point, Gina?
It's unbelievable when you look. Yeah, I mean, when you look at what everything that Google has done in aggregate in 2009, it's really crazy. I mean,
and
it's
accelerating.
Three
it's
main launches of the year.
It's happened faster in the last month. It's incredible.
What were your main
I mean, the end
points,
of the year,
Gina?
They were busier, it seemed, than the beginning.
Yes.
Yeah.
Continue on. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, that's okay. I mean, the three big launches of the year, which from where I sat, were Wave, Chrome, Chromium OS, and Android, you know, the Droid, Android 2.0, were actually, you know, for the regular consumer, not exactly, you know, earth-shattering. A lot of people still aren't on Wave, and Chromium OS was just a demo. I mean, that's not even out, you know, and the Google Experience release build isn't even out. The Droid is still very, you know, not very widely used. And it's interesting to me, and I love it as a developer, that these are all open source products that are out earlier, you know, that are out for developers to play with and for people to try out, you know, before the actual final release, with the exception of Android. Chromium OS and Wave are still really preview. But I think that they, you know, lay this groundwork for the next few years that's going to be pretty incredible stuff. I mean, we're moving really entirely into the cloud, entirely into real time, entirely into having these powerful computers in our pocket that can do so many things on, you know, on a fast network. I mean, this year was a big one, even though, you know, regular Joe Schmo isn't going like, oh, Google blew my mind this year.
Right. No, Joe Schmo has no idea.
No, well, except that's where I picked up from where Gina was and tried to patch together the discussion we had last week. And I looked at it in two ways. The first is Google getting closer and closer to intent on search. And that's why goggles and visual search matter and voice search matters. It's location, why the thing that last week amazed me, the search for weather in CH, and you get the weather in the search box before you even ask the question, they give you the answer. So that's one area. That's their core area. But then they've got to move past search. Bitly, you know, it grows by the minute because human links grow by the minute. I'll get to my number of the week in a minute. Then you look at mobile and local. And that's where, you know, I wrote this before the Yelp thing even came up. But you start to see where they get to the idea of knowing we're going to have a constantly connected device and what all they can anticipate and give us in there, and then as a result target the hell out of us for advertising. And it's a beautiful thing for them.
Essentially, I think where we're headed is a heads-up display somehow that basically, you know, it's augmented reality that is at every moment giving you, I mean, we're very close to that. Google's very close to, a full-time connection to Google and just look around you. Google says, what do you want to know about?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I could tell you anything you want to know about any of these things. And Wikipedia feeds into that. And
right. Where are you? Who are you? What are you doing now? Plus add in Google DNS and a Google OS so it really can know us as it goes along.
Are we sheep being led to the slaughter, though? I mean, are we willing to Google give? I mean, when it does this, it's this incredibly compelling offer. And no one is going to say no. Everyone is going to opt in. And Google then becomes the arbiter of all information. They become Skynet.
This is when you need sound
and effects. And by the time we realize there won't be any more Yellow Pages that we can fall back on.
It's too late.
That was interesting for me going to Paris because I'm so used to using my phone to tell me where to go now. And it didn't work there. I've got a Droid. I could use it for Wi-Fi. I couldn't use it anywhere else. And it was like, oh, right. Yeah, there are these things in them called maps that I can look at to find where I get to the destination. I remember this from the 80s, you know. And it was like a trip back in time for me. Yes. No, it was just on the walls of the metro, right? Well, yeah, you go in the metro, there's a map. Yeah. Then you get to the destination, there's a local map. You know, it's a system that's been there 100 years that works, but I'm so used to carrying this thing around, it's saying turn left here.
I think there's going to be a nostalgia movement, just as there is with vinyl records, of people who want Yellow Pages and paper maps, and they're going to be seen as very retro and bizarre. They're going to wear Edwardian clothes.
A secret society of Yellow Pages.
It's just steampunk, yeah.
Pull it out.
It's
very
let me pull out my map. Wow, that's interesting.
Should we talk about the Twitter hack this weekend and security a little bit?
Yes, please do. What happened? This was the Iranian thing?
Yeah, the Iranian thing. So the Twitter homepage, I think it was it Friday night or Thursday night?
Thursday. I think it was Thursday.
I think for an hour. Was it Thursday night? Yeah. For an hour was redirected to, I forget what it's called. It was called like the Iranian Cyber Hacker Squad or something.
What the hell?
I mean, after all the Twitter has been through, you would think at this point, But TechCrunch wrote up how it happened, and basically they had the attackers had been able to take over the email address that the Twitter had registered with their DNS service. So, you know, they went and sent a password reset email and had gotten into the account, and then just, so it was just a DNS redirect. So they didn't actually hack into the Twitter servers.
Right.
They just said, this IP address should go now to our
page.
They
said, we own Twitter.com.
The right?
They
were database able, wasn't compromised.
Who, just out of curiosity, did we know who the domain registrar was that was so blithely said, oh, Twitter's moved to Iran. I mean, what the hell?
The service is called... Dyn, D-Y-N. I hadn't heard of it before.
Dyn DNS.
It's pronounced Dyn. Dyn
DNS.
Sure.
No, they. You know what? That's right. That's.
I think it's just Dyn.
It's the same company.
It's not the same thing.
It's the same company. Yes, it is. Because we were we were talking about some security issues with Dyn DNS, and their parent company runs Twitter's servers. I forgot about that.
But I mean, it really wasn't their fault because they got into the account because they sent the password. You know, the Twitter's email
the
address wasn't set up. No, I know. They just
sent
a password. So the December reminder to everyone is to double check your secondary email accounts. Make sure that your passwords are secure, that your webmail accounts are all active, that no one can just go reset up that Hotmail account you used and send a Google account password reset.
And by the way, Apple is not moving to Vladivostok. So if you get any more mail saying Apple is moving to, that's not true. Jeez. You would think there'd be some sanity check, but I guess maybe it's fully automated. God, that's
yeah. It seems that way. Oh, it does seem
hurt.
That way.
That's got to really hurt. I want to get to our tool tip and number of the week in just a bit before we do anything in that direction. Anybody have another story that you want us to cover before we move on? Going. This has been a great conversation, by the way. Just fascinating conversation.
The other interesting Twitter one this week was the WordPress and Postgres implementing the Twitter API. I thought that was interesting. I was interested to see what Gina thought of that one.
I love that idea because it disintermediates Twitter. And this was Twitter's Achilles heel, right? Because they have this great API. And can you copyright an API?
So actually, I missed this story. So what happened? So they implemented the API so that you can make requests to the blogging services versus Twitter.com proper?
Twitter, you can use your Twitter third-party tools to post to Postgres or WordPress.com.
Interesting.
So explain that to me.
Well, it means that because the API is published and well-known, anybody could say, okay, just this happened with Blogger, Kevin, right? The Blogger API, the Blogger RPC, became the de facto way to post to a blog.
Yeah. And, you know, there's a bunch of us been going around saying we should come up with some standards for this stuff for a while. This is the activity streams thing and all that stuff.
Right.
That's going okay. But Twitter was like, oh, we like what we've done. And so the others have now said, oh, well, if people are using your API, why don't we just clone it? So Matt and co at WordPress did this first, and the Postgres guys did it later in the week, where you could now use some of the Twitter clients where you can actually set the endpoint to read and write to those as well.
Bypassing Twitter.
That's fantastic.
Isn't that great?
Got it.
So it's
that is awesome.
Emulating the Twitter API. Yeah. So that's interesting. I'm not sure it's necessarily the best thing because the Twitter API isn't as rich as all the other APIs.
It would be nice if we had a nice open API that was designed for this. But
that's what
Dave
Weiner was saying this week. That it doesn't happen that way.
That doesn't happen that way.
Are emergent and they come out often, or standards are emergent and they come out of people's behavior. And somebody says, "Good idea, I'll do that too," and boom, you're all there.
Right. Unfortunately, that's
to some extent. I mean, you know, there are standards that are designed as well.
Yeah,
But the good ones are based on practice. You know, the bad ones are made up from scratch by somebody in an
ivory tower
somewhere in Massachusetts. and the good ones tend to be put together by. Oh, we're doing this thing. Why don't we get together and see if we can agree it? You know, if you look at OAuth and those standards, they come through that process. So it's interesting to see. And it was, you know, as someone who's been poking the Twitter guys about, it would be nice if you came to more standards meetings. This is a sort of interesting twist on that.
They kind of won. What's wrong with the Twitter API?
Nothing's wrong for its purpose for Twitter. It doesn't actually... It's like my analogy is the difference between a t-shirt and a suit. If the Twitter API is like, you know, like the Facebook API is really well fitted for the purpose there. What you need for a general case is something that's slightly looser fitting that'll map to more places.
Right.
So, you know, the Twitter API isn't a perfect fit for a blog, but it's similar enough that you can make it work.
Yeah.
But you'll find that some things don't quite make sense in that world because you have to map. Say, okay, if I'm retweeting, what does that mean? With Postgres, it means I'm reblogging. With WordPress, not clear what it means.
Right.
If I'm replying, is that a comment on the blog or is that a post to my own blog? You know, the mapping isn't perfectly exact, and you've got to decide what it means. But it's close enough that you can do it.
But then, Kevin, isn't the old mapping of the blog world what's the suit and limited when you put it that way?
Well, you know, Twitter was a blog service to begin with. Sure,
you could argue that.
Yeah. Well, the point is, you know, what?
Yeah, you can argue that, but if Twitter is not going to implement that,
right? Yeah. Just let it happen.
If Twitter, you know, if to give an example, Twitter won't do enclosures. This is, you know, Dave Weiner's crusade for Twitter. Mm. Give me a way to attach MP3 files to Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
The blogs have ways of doing that. So, how do we do that now? Well, we'd have to work out a mapping that sort of degrades down to something that works for Twitter to post it as a link, and then we have to reverse the short link and decide it's an MP3 and do a whole bunch of extra code to deal with that.
But isn't that what TwitPic does? You know it's a brand, and the clients tend to know that it's a photo and displays the photo in the client.
Right, but it knows it's TwitPic. It doesn't, you know, some of them work with Flickr, some of them don't. Some of them work with YFrog, some of them don't. For each URL, you actually have to go there and sit there and fetch it and then sniff it and say, was that a JPEG? Was that a page that contains a JPEG? How do I know if this is a photo service?
Or you know that the URL always has JPEGs. So Dave Weiner tomorrow could start, and you, fathers of podcasting, could start a new enclosure brand tomorrow.
Right.
Right.
You'd have to go and talk to every client and say, by the way, you know,
they'll just
KevinBaysPhoto.com is a photo service.
But that's beautiful thing about the client world. The client, it's like a federation because the clients are keeping up on this.
Yeah, but it's a weak way to do it because how many? I mean, you're going to have 100 of these.
You know, compared to putting an image tag there this is an image, it's a fairly clunky way of doing it.
Yeah.
But I also can see it's a world where you throw out a feature and if there's critical mass behind it, it will get adoption. If there isn't, it won't.
Sure.
And it's not unlike, you know, the fact that a hashtag became a hashtag only because it gained critical mass.
Yeah.
So I kind of like that emergent sense of it rather than the committee sense of it.
But technologists hate it because it's so disorderly. And
that's why I like it. I like to make them nervous and give them congestion.
You're making Kevin very nervous. I
know I am.
I've been advocating for empirical standards, emergent standards. You know, that's you know, what we do is we say, okay, clearly six of us are trying to do something that's really similar here. How about we agree on how to do it rather than doing it slightly?
Eventually you want a standard. You don't want it all ad hoc because it's just... That's crazy,
but then you don't have to sort of do it through business relationships. You can do it through reading the spec, and that's the thing that helps in the end.
Right, Gina, you've worked with this API.
I have, and you know, I have a whole block of code that says if this is twitpic.com, do this. Ugh. If this is YFrog, do this. So I mean, you know, if a leader came out and said, okay, I'm going to publish an XML file and keep it updated of all the mapping the what photo services to their method calls, and then so my client has to query that every time. That's cool, but I would rather it was just an enclosure standard.
Right.
That said, this is great.
Isn't that kind of a meta? Sorry. No, isn't that kind of a meta DNS then?
Yeah. That's what it would be. It's just that, you know, and then if someone Kevin launches his photo service, he has to let the intermediary, organization know they have to update. And then my client has to, but then like my client's making all these other, and it's complicated. It's a more complex way to do it than if you just, you know, supported enclosures in the standard. But that being said, if the Twitter API has been implemented in a wide number of really great clients on a lot of different platforms. So the fact that you can post to other services using it means that if all the clients make configurable endpoints, meaning that you can say, hey, when I post a status update, you know, post it to my blog here, post it to Twitter here, post it to the rest of these places. It's great for everyone. It's great for developers because you don't have to rewrite code. It's great for users because you can access, you know, many platforms from one single interface. And it's great for the clients because suddenly they become multi-tools and they're not just Twitter tools.
Explain this to me. If that happens, and if I used the Twitter API to never update Twitter, to only update WordPress, which I could do, right?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
then what control does Twitter still have over the API if everybody agrees to an enclosure and Twitter doesn't do it, but everybody else is doing it?
So if everyone else agrees to enclosures and Twitter doesn't, that means that your client, I mean, should be able to do those, have that extra feature if you're just posting to your blog and not Twitter, and Twitter wouldn't. Twitter wouldn't, you know, be able to, wouldn't have any control over that. I don't believe that you can trademark method calls and interfaces. I don't think that you can copyright an API, although I'm not positive. But I'm pretty sure that you could say we support the Twitter API plus all this other stuff as well.
And could Twitter do anything about that? If they, I'm not sure that they would necessarily have to dislike it, but if they did, is there any way they could torpedo it?
I don't believe so. I don't think so. But I'm not.
Well, there's a real risk there. If you change the API out from under stuff like this, there's the real risk that you'll leave behind all the people who are writing to the API. You can't just kind of say, oh, that's deprecated.
Well,
now.
You would overload the API versus change it, right? So you would, all the methods should work, you know, and match and parallel Twitter's, but you'd overload them for the other services that can do the extra stuff, and Twitter just couldn't do that. So that's how you'd have to handle it, really.
So if your Twitter, go the other way. If Twitter is smart, and they are, how do they take advantage of this?
There's no defense.
So do they you know, convene committees to agree to all these other things that even they never thought of? Is there a way that they can embrace this?
Well, potentially, but they'd have to, you know, basically set up they've already got a discussion forum for, we want new things in our API, can you add them? So they could make that less of a please do this for me, Twitter, you know, the Microsoft approach to APIs, and make it more like an open source model where people can submit patches and things. But that would take a fair change for them.
Yeah, I mean, if the most popular Twitter client supports enclosures and lots of people are using it to post to their blog, I think that's a very compelling reason for Twitter to consider that addition to the API versus, you know, a couple of forum posts when people saying, hey, we'd really like to do this.
That what's happening already with TwitPic and YFrog and all of these? I mean, it's de facto enclosures.
They operate differently with it. All right, I specialize in ignorant questions, so my latest. Is there an open source API? There are open source code bases, but is there an open source API like what you just described, Kevin?
Open Social was a good example. Open Social is an API that's designed for a whole bunch of different social networks to do this kind of thing, and includes, you know, identity. It includes activity streams and a few bits and pieces like that. And the way changes happen to it is people propose them to the standards group, they debate it, and then they issue a new version of the standard with code. And that's, you know, the IETF is an organization that's built on this model, right? The IETF that does the internet standards is designed to let you create new standards by reference to old standards, and you debate them and you create interoperating implementations and post them to that and extend them over time. So there is history here.
But the difference here could be that Twitter could become that body. If Twitter embraced this, they would become like the IETF and say, okay, we're going to help everybody do this in a more sane way. They could do that.
Over everybody else's dead body.
Right.
The IETF is, a standards committee is by definition not a single corporate interest, right? It wouldn't be.
Yeah.
It wouldn't be the same.
Yeah, I mean, that's what the Open Web Foundation was set up to try and make it easier for people to do this kind of thing. What we've seen over the last couple of years is that the new standards end up having to set up some governing body. You can agree to changes to it and deal with. And the point of the Open Web Foundation was to provide a template so people could do that. So that would be one answer. We would say, okay, we use the Open Web Foundation template to administer this. But it still comes out of having the will to say, yes, we're handing over control of this to a third party. We're not going to own it ourselves. And that's a difficult thing to do.
Okay, I'm delaying my own pizza, but one more question.
You are. You're delaying pizza now. Go ahead.
Sorry. So the fact that, you know, two things happened this week. Google announced its own URL shortening service. Meanwhile, Bitly came out with a pro version and also some neat stuff like Bitly Video, where they can tear apart the URLs and find out what the most popular videos are. So does the shortening service become kind of a parallel API to all this? And you find different features with different shortening services? And what happens if people use Google's versus Bitly's or the New York Times's or Bitly's private labeled ones? Does that complicate our world again too, or am I just being dumb?
No, it does complicate things, right? Because some photo services, for example, I think like TweetPhoto lets you do things that maybe YFrog doesn't let you do, like comment or star or have friends. And so Bitly offers statistics on clicks that maybe, you know, other shortening services don't, right? So and that's part of the reason why some people like to use some over the other. Over the others. I like Bitly because it gives me stats. I'm not even really sure if Google's new shortening service does that. So no, it complicates things, right? Because then it becomes is the stats and the extra stuff that you can do with the shortening or with the enclosure, is that part of the API as well? I mean, is, you know, in order to be a shortener or an image host for Twitter, do you have to support, you know, should you support these extra things? It's a good question. Everyone's kind of overloading things.
Did you sign up for Pro? The Bitly Pro? Did you sign up for
that? I have not yet, but I very well may.
Yeah, a lot of people
haven't tried that yet.
Is it fantastic?
I don't know. I'm asking you. I don't know.
It lets you do is you make your
it becomes a private label service, right?
You know, yeah.
Right.
I'm not sure what you make it, yeah.
Yeah. So
TW.
I can have
/whatever.
I tried to get tw.it, but you have to be Italian, unfortunately.
Did
anybody speak? That's another thing I wonder, by the way. All these two tinhorn dictators that own these suffixes, if one of them pulled out, if I don't know where .ly is.
Libya. Don't you love Libya? Hey, hello? Gaddafi. Hello, Gaddafi.
We've put our necks on the line with Libya.
Yeah.
And they can pull out and they can hold us up now and say all that data you have is now useless.
That's an interesting point.
They could do that,
that's a good point.
Jack, that happened to Twitter by fiat because they're the government. Yeah,
right.
That's true.
We own .ly.
Every Bitly URL to Gaddafi fan page.
Oh, that would be dastardly. Dastardly. Wow.
Not that I want to give anybody any ideas. Sorry, Ben.
Once again. All right, we're gonna take a break.
Just
come back.
Tuvalu shut you down.
Yeah. When Tuvalu sinks, what are we gonna do? There'll be no .tv. Then I'm in trouble. We're gonna take a break. Come back in just a bit with your tip of the week, Gina Trapani. Your number of the week, Jeff Jarvis, and I have a tool of the week, and we'll just let you say anything you want, Kevin Marks. Anything at all.
I have to think of something. Okay.
Think of something clever to say. It could be. What about your epigram of the week? I think that's Kevin should have an epigram.
Epigram of the week. Wow.
Yeah. You have a minute.
I have a minute to think about that
start
one.
Start spinning. But first, I want to tell you, ladies and gentlemen, about my great Ford Sync. I think this is absolutely a transformational technology in cars. And in fact, I understand some major announcements coming from Ford at CES. We'll be there and we will cover it. Ford Sync is the hands-free Bluetooth phone capability in all Ford Lincoln and new Ford Lincoln and Mercury vehicles, but it's more than that because it's also a way that you control your media player. When my iPhone is connected, it starts playing back audio from the Bluetooth. I can listen to music. If I connect it up via USB, because every Ford Sync vehicle has a USB port, you can then index all the stuff on your Ford Sync, and you can say play This Week in Google episode 21, and it starts playing. You can say play the Beatles, you can play next, play previous, play similar. I mean, it is just incredible. And I have a feeling that we're going to see some very interesting developments. I think Ford Sync is the iPhone of car computers. I want you to try it. You can do a couple of things. Go to SyncMyRidePodcast.com for a tour of what Ford Sync can do and to learn more about it. Or just go to your local Ford, Lincoln, and Mercury dealer. You don't have to say, I want to drive the car. Say, I'd like to test drive the Sync. See what they say. Ford Sync. It is incredible. And if you're in the market for a new auto, I highly encourage you to take a look at Ford, Lincoln, or Mercury vehicles just for the Sync alone. SyncMyRidePodcast.com is the URL. Gina Trapani, it's time for your tip of the week, my dear. I sound like W.C. Fields.
So,
my dear, it's your tip of the week.
So this week, Google launched a useful little addition to your Gmail contacts list, which is your contacts for your entire Google account. If you go into your contacts, you can. There's a new button that says Find Duplicates.
Hallelujah!
And it will do just that. It'll show you names that appear twice. So you know, if you have a friend who emails you from one address and then emails you from another address later, that person appears twice in your contacts. But if you hit that Find Duplicates button, it will show you a list of the names that appear to be dupes, and then you can, in one shot, you can check off the ones that are indeed dupes and hit a Merge button, and it'll just merge them all together and clean up your contacts list in one shot.
Much needed. Does it do a good job?
It does a great job.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah.
It shrunk my contacts list by like 50 people who I had doubles of.
Hallelujah. Well, you get doubles also because of Gmail copying addresses of people you send mail to and not knowing that it's in that contact. And so you get all these extra little...
Dude, yep.
I look forward to that. That's great. Mm-hmm. I will try it immediately. Jeff Jarvis.
Glad to ship that.
Pardon me?
Really glad that ship. I remember they were building that when I was there, so that's been coming for a while. So that's good.
Yeah, yeah. Anytime you have synchronization, you've got to have deduplication.
Yes.
Is that a word?
Yeah.
Jeff,
I think so.
It made sense to us, but no one
in my world. It definitely is.
I don't think there's a "fu" in there, but anyway, deduplification sounds right somehow. Jeff Jarvis, what's your number of the week?
2 billion.
$2 billion.
I've been crowing about how Google News does 1 billion clicks a month and Bitly had matched that. Well, now Bitly has doubled that. And the Bitly blog says that they're now at 2 billion clicks a month.
Jiminy.
Caused. Which is awe-inspiring and amazing. But it also, I think, does raise the concern that we spoke about a minute ago, is that we've lost the transparency of addresses on the web. And so it's very hard for us to gather around addresses and find the heat. And there are intermediaries who now we have to go to decode addresses again. It becomes, as we said a minute ago, in another context, a kind of shadow meta DNS. And in a way, that's troubling, I think, that we've made addresses opaque again. Nonetheless, give credit to Bitly, and also note, I think, the importance of this, that if you add up Bitly plus all its competitors, you have the growth of the human link and the power of the human link again versus just the search and the algorithmic means of discovery.
Amazing. Bitly, I think, is an amazing service, I have to say. I'm really looking forward to trying these things. And I don't care what Muammar Gaddafi wants. Now, this actually ties very well into... I'm going to do two tools because one, of course, is the one Gina mentioned, these Google shortening, GOO.GL. And I don't know who runs Greenland, but we can hope that they will be a benign...
They're nice up there.
Superpower protecting us with our shortened links via Google. Now, it doesn't seem like it has a whole lot of features. There's no Bitly, let's put it that way. But I wouldn't put the guys in Mountain View out of the picture. I'm sure at some point it will have a lot of features. And certainly there's a pretty clear roadmap of where you go with a URL shortening.
Well, let's start the rumor right now that Google's going to buy Bitly. It's not true. I know nothing, but what the heck? Let's make a rumor.
Yeah, that's how Mike works. That's fine.
Oh.
You said that, I didn't. GOO.GL, and there is a Chrome extension if you want to do it automatically in there. I really don't know why anybody would, to be honest, would use this as opposed to Bitly, but there's a reason. There's certainly a reason why Google is doing it, and they say the core goals of the service are stability, security, and speed. And I think I'd have to add a fourth, Greenland. Also, this is the tool I was going to start with. It's Google browser size. This is kind of a oddball tool, but you can it's bizarre. But it's you can see how much of your page as a web designer people can see.
I think that's such a stupid tool. Okay, can I rant about this for a minute?
Yes, please.
It's like, first of all, if my screen's only that wide, the layout changes because I've done my page properly.
Right.
Secondly, my little screen zoom in and out now. And thirdly, guess what? People scroll. You know, this whole above the fold crap.
It's kind of antiquated, isn't it?
For 10 years, and it isn't true that people actually scroll down and look at stuff.
I just think it looks cool. Let me be honest with you.
It looks cool, but it's propagating the wrong thing.
It's one of those great informatics that makes you really think you're learning something when in fact, you're learning nothing at all.
People don't read the top inch, right? People don't read the top inch because they expect a banner ad to be there. You put stuff in that top inch, nobody sees it.
Right.
Because they look down an inch below it. There's a whole science of eye tracking here. There's a whole set of actually observing people's behavior and what they do, and this is doing this in the crudest, stupidest way possible. I expect better from Google, really.
Did you guys see thereisnopagefold.com, yes, which I think launched on the same day? Matt Howey said that he loved the irony.
I love it. There is no page fold. This no is page fold. The internet.
Plus, it I think the whole notion of homepages goes away. The notion of the homepage is just silly. That's where you package the world, and most traffic doesn't come in through the homepage.
Right.
And so I say there should be no homepages.
Welcome to the World Wide Web, an interactive medium in which screen resolution statistics are trivial, browser view reports are variable, and scrolling behavior is a standard.
That's keep going.
Go down. There is no page fold. There's more.
Keep going.
Go all the way to the bottom. You can tell because you got a little scroll thing. Love your scroll bar. Okay, so my tool sucked, but it did give us a great conversation, and that's all I really care about. It's been really good having you all on. Kevin Marks, thanks for joining us. It's always a pleasure.
Great to be back.
Of course, Kevin's blog is epeus.blogspot.com. But is there anywhere else you'd like to plug? Anything else you'd like to let us know about?
Oh, I was thinking, look at Ribbit Mobile. I think that's interesting. So
Ribbit, yeah.
Go there and sign up.
RIBBIT Mobile from a service of British Telecom. And is it just for Wave, or is it for anybody?
No, anything? No. It's a service. It transcribes it well and sends it to you as an SMS.
Okay, and I hope that whatever he said will come to me as an SMS soon.
That's some clever stuff.
Good. Ribbit, yeah. RIBBIT.com. Thank you, Kevin. It's great to talk to you. Mr. Jeff Jarvis is always available at buzzmachine.com, his great blog, which is a must read. He's one of the best bloggers out there. I really enjoy it. And don't forget the book, What Would Google Do? In edition 29 now, or whatever it is. How many editions? How many
printings? We have 11 printings.
11 printings. Amazing. Gina Trapani's blog is smarterware.org. She's also the author of The Complete Guide to Google Wave at completewaveguide.com. And she's in the snowstorm now.
Yes, sir.
So she will never come back to San Diego again. She's buried in avalanche.
Not till next year.
You and Jeff stay warm and enjoy your holidays. We will be back here the on Boxing Day if you guys wish to continue to do a show the day after Christmas. You up for it?
I'm up for it.
Okay.
I'm hoping I can get back in time. Yep.
If not, we'll postpone, but I think it'd be fun to do it. And then the day after New Year's, we'll have our first show of 2010. As I mentioned, you can see us now on YouTube, which is great news, youtube.com/twit. We also have video versions available at twit.tv and soon to be on iTunes as well. And on the Roku box and lots of other places too. Watch the show in video. You can see how silly we all look. I'm Leo Laporte. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time on This Week in Google.